a full house.
Chad didn't get his 1v1, his one-on-one session.
Okay. Questions? So we finished chapter 2, a final example. And it's an example that has, you know, some kind of real merit in the sense that it's not a terrible model for a nucleus to think about a square well potential as being like the force that holds the neutrons and protons to a nucleus. And what we found was a handful, at least one, of bound states, energy less than zero, normalizable, alternating, even, and odd, and a continuum of positive energy, unnormalizable scattering states. And the particular scattering state we worked with, and the book kind of does a more general case, but I don't know, this is particular enough. All the other ones work the same. So we started out with a wave function that was an incoming and a reflected wave and a transmitted wave. And in the well, we had some linear combination of sine and cosine. And we matched psi and psi prime at x equals 0 and x equals L, constituted four equations and four unknowns. So we're able to find the reflection, transmission, and these internal coefficients for the sine and cosine. And the reflection behavior was, I don't know, pretty much as you would have expected based on the delta function potential, right? So for low energy incoming waves, you get 100% reflection. And for higher energy, you're able to get some transmission. There are some oscillations that happen when you can fit an integer number of waves, of Q waves, in the box. Questions? It's all so clear that the homework was a breeze. Okay, well, if that all was a breeze, then a review of linear algebra should be just as easy. What do you remember about linear algebra?
A lot of things.
Some things more than others. Yeah, so we had these ideas of linear combination and basis. What else? Say again? Yeah, so I think that I assume that that's mostly what you did in linear algebra was deal with vector spaces. What's a vector space? Yeah, okay. What are all of the conditions of being a vector space?
It's closed under addition and scale
doesn't necessarily have an identity matrix. It has to have a zero vector. So basically, addition and multiplication were like normal, right? So they were commutative and associative, and there was an additive inverse. And that's a whole lot less than we require of what we would call a vector in physics, which to a mathematician would actually be a tensor. So linear algebras have fewer properties than a physics kind of vector. And kind of the next thing that you would want to add to get closer to being a physics vector is something like a dot product. A dot product is not not a necessary part of a vector space per se. And mathematicians like to call this an inner product, because they're going to define an outer product. And the dot product has to have some required properties, namely that if we dot two vectors together, it's guaranteed to be greater than or equal to zero, and it equals zero if and only if V is the zero vector. And otherwise, it is breaks apart linearly the way any old good dot product would. Now, one thing that I suspect is a little bit different is compared to what you did as sophomores is that linear algebras, vector spaces, are defined over a field. And you, my guess is that you use the real numbers as your favorite field. And now, of course, we're going to be using complex numbers as our field. So the scalars we're going to be talking about can be complex numbers, and that changes a little bit about what's going to be required for this dot product. So we're going to now talk about the dot product over a complex vector space, and it's going to have all of these same properties, except linearity is going to work a little bit differently. That is to say, if I have a vector here that is alpha A plus beta B, and I'm dotting that with V, then what's going to come out, of course, are complex conjugates. Right? Because that side is complex conjugated. Whereas if the alpha and beta are on the right-hand side, then they would come out just as normal real numbers. I give you some kind of warning. If you pick up a random math book, which one of these two is the one that gets complex conjugated is not a decided thing. That is to say, some mathematicians will make this thing the thing that gets complex conjugated as opposed to the other one. It's just a matter of notation, not any big deal. And in addition, if we take the complex conjugate of this whole thing, all it does is turn it around. And I think you can see that kind of the obvious definition of dot product for finite dimensional vector spaces is going to work just fine, right? We're going to add up the components of W complex conjugated multiplied by the components of V not complex conjugated. The way we can actually implement this with normal sort of operations, we can try and make this into a matrix operation, in which case what we can have is V being a column vector and W being a row vector, which gets complex conjugated, and then normal matrix multiplication is going to work just fine. So we can make kind of a big deal between things that are column vectors and things that are row vectors. And then we can put them together. And traditionally in physics, we're going to call things like this a ket, and things like this a bra, and then things like this a bra ket. So we can put things together in, a perhaps useful sort of notation. Well, we've got operators. And the claim is that operators are going to correspond to matrices. confusingly, matrices themselves are a vector space, right? You can take linear combination of vectors of matrices and make a vector space of matrix, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a linear operator which maps a vector to a vector. And if we know what happens to the basis vectors from linearity, then we can figure out what happens to any old vector. So kind of as a starting point, if I have some operator T, which is operating on some vector V, let me instead have it operate on one of the basis vectors, EI. And of course, what I have to get out is a linear combination of the basis vectors, right? Everything has to be there. And now I make kind of a, and actually let me switch over to a more physics-y notation. Have those all be kets. So now kind of the detail is, what should I name those expansion coefficients? The expansion coefficients obviously depend on what I started with, and I have to have a sum over these j's. And with malice aforethought, I decide to put the i's and the j's in that order. So what happens if I have the operator S that operates on the results of T and V? And of course, we can understand what happens to this if we know what happens to the basis vectors. So if we start out with this, what we've got is S operating on this. And S is linear, so that means we can break this thing apart. And this thing here, we can write as the sum. And what I call the sum index doesn't matter. This time I'm going to call it K. So this is going to be the sum of SK J, because it's operating on J, E sub K. So if I put these things together, I've got a sum over J and K of TJI SKJ EK. And if these are just numbers, I can reverse the order. Can't reverse the order of matrices, but those are numbers. And I hope you recognize what we've got here is the matrix product of TS, its kith component. And that's exactly the sort of thing we would get here. So evidently, the matrix that represents the composite operator is just the matrix multiplication of the operator that represents T and the operator that and the matrix that represents T. Okay, so matrices represent arbitrary operators. What operations can we have on matrices? Well, we can, of course, take linear combinations of them, but that is neither here nor there. Transpose, that's where we switch things around the diagonal. And pretty much any place I've ever seen uses a capital T superscript to denote transpose. Griffith is going to use this twiddle to indicate transpose. Luckily, basically, it's only going to occur in this appendix, so we don't have to worry about the odd notation. You could do other things like take the complex conjugate of it. Right, so that would be a star. And you can do both of those things together, right? So we could take the transpose complex conjugate, and you know, mathematicians like to name things for famous dead mathematicians. So this is called the Hermite. And Griffiths and everyone else in the world that I've ever seen denotes that with a dagger. And I think they use a dagger because it looks a lot like the transpose, because it's kind of like the transpose with a little bit of extra stuff going on it. So if we look at what happens if we have this sort of thing, so remember, in terms of a matrix sort of indication, this would be a row vector which is complex conjugated, and then we would have the matrix T, and then we would have the column vector V. And now we have kind of a interesting property. So you're probably, usually when you have matrix multiplication, you have matrix multiplications of things that are square. And here they're not square, right? One is one has just one row and one has lots of rows and columns. But the following theorem applies to any bit of matrix multiplication. If we have A times B transposed, it's the same thing as B transpose times A transpose. And I'm sure that you did this in linear algebra, but maybe it's worth doing. So A times B by itself, if we were to look at its ij component, that would be normal matrix multiplication. If we transpose that, and we want its ij value, that's going to be a, j, k, b, k, I. And of course that is a transpose k, j, b, I, k transposed. And now if we just put these things together, we have something that looks like matrix multiplication. Oops, these were K's. So what that means is we can bring this transpose inside, and so we can have the transpose of T times W complex conjugated. Well, not so much, because the T is going to get complex conjugated too. But if I complex conjugate T twice, it's not going to hurt. So if I make that a dagger, I'm all set. So what we've got then is the Hermitian conjugate of T acting on W has the same overlap, same bracket, as the original one did. So kind of the without thinking action, you should just think that you can move an operator from one side to the other at the cost of taking its Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so some nomenclature. A matrix is symmetric if its transpose is equal to its matrix, and its Hermitian if its Hermitian conjugate is equal to itself. And then this looks particularly simple, right? If this is Hermitian, then we can just say the T could be on the left or the right, and it doesn't make any difference. And we've seen that with a couple of operators already, right? X, of course, didn't matter whether it was complex conjugated or not because it was real. We showed that the P could be on the left or the right. The I does change sign, but the integration by parts switches that around anyway. So the P could be on either side. And same thing for the Hamiltonian. So in fact, all the operators we've talked about have been Hermitian. And that's in fact, I shouldn't say all, the A was not Hermitian, right? A dagger was distinct from A, the raising and lowering operators. The claim will be that every physical variable, everything that you can measure, is a Hermitian operator. So they're going to play a big role. What's going to play an increasingly large role in quantum mechanics, but maybe not so much in this class, is what are called unitary matrices. And talk about unitary matrices, I'm going to talk about orthogonal matrices. So orthogonal matrices are matrices, when you take the transpose, you get the inverse. And turns out that rotation matrices in any dimensions, 2, 3, 4 dimensions, are always orthogonal matrices. For unitary matrices, you might guess, if I take the Hermitian conjugate, I get the inverse of the matrix. Okay. So I think probably the only thing that is new or memorable so far is these names, Bra and Ket, and the idea that these we're going to make a big distinction between whether something's a row vector or a column vector. Incidentally, Mathematica doesn't make a big distinction whether something is a row vector or a column vector. So you know how you would write normally a vector in Mathematica would be something like that. And technically, that's something that has one row. And so it would be a ket. If you really wanted to write a column vector in Mathematica, it should have a first row that is 1, and a second row that is 2, and a third row that is 3. That also works for most things in Mathematica. But Mathematica will happily do, for this V, it will happily do matrix multiplication, which is a period, on this side, and it will do matrix multiplication on that side. It doesn't require this kind of funky notation for a column vector.
So you can put a matrix in Mathematica and period multiply.
Yes. So maybe I should say how you put a matrix into Mathematica. Right, so if we have the matrix that is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, then Mathematica wants that written. The first row is A, B, C. The next row is D, E, F, etc. Okay, so the thing that my bet is that you covered just at the end of linear algebra is the thing that we probably care about the most, and you already know these names, eigenvectors and eigenfunctions. And incidentally, the Mathematica has a function for eigenvectors, and it has a function for eigenvalues, and it also has a function that gives you both kind of at the same time, which is called eigensystem. I can't remember if this is a capital S or not. I'm going to capitalize it. So is that, first of all, is that what you call them? Do you remember that name? Sometimes mathematicians call these characteristic vectors and characteristic values. We call them eigen. Good. So, I don't know, physically, before we try and talk about this mathematically, physically, what's kind of a physical example of an eigenvector? And, I don't know, you might not like this example because it takes you back a year. Do you remember your moment of inertia tensor? Maybe I shouldn't do this as a tilde because that looks like transpose. I'll use that for a matrix. Yeah, sometimes more than others. So the claim to fame of the moment of inertia tensor is that if I dotted it with the angular velocity, I got the angular momentum. And in 191, the angular momentum was always in the same direction as omega, but it ain't necessarily so for an oddly shaped object. But it is the case along the principal axes of an object. So for a principal axis, the angular momentum is in the same direction as omega. So the principal axes are the eigenvectors of the moment of inertia tensor. And those corresponding principal moments of inertia are the eigenvalues. Okay, so there's special directions that that have the particular nice this particular nice property. Well, if you don't, and you do, if you don't have Mathematica, how would you go about finding these eigenvectors or values? Something that, I don't know, you might imaginably have to do on an exam, but in real life, one would use Mathematica. Yep. So if I have this equation, what's the conclusion? Well, I can put everything on one side of the equation by the following. I can take the matrix minus lambda and the unit matrix, because the unit matrix dotted into V is V, and that has to give me zero. So if V is in the null space of that parentheses matrix, that is to say, if it's annihilated by that matrix that's in parentheses, then it must be that this thing is non-invertible. And I don't know, just to write an example of this, so if we have our previous matrix that is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, what this thing here, of course, is just with minus lambdas down the diagonal. And if something doesn't have an inverse, then its determinant is zero. And so what we have then is once we take the determinant, we have a polynomial equation to solve. We need to find the roots of that polynomial, and then those will be the eigenvalues. Once you've got the eigenvalues, really the hard part is just beginning, because then you have to figure out what vector is going to be annihilated by this quantity. So that's just a matter of solving n equations and n unknowns, but it usually looks kind of like a mess. So all of this looks like a mess. Finding that determinant for anything more than 3 by 3 is a mess. Finding the roots of the resulting polynomial is a mess if it's not a quadratic, which would be just a 2 by 2. And then finding the corresponding vector is a mess. And I think I have, you can use Mathematica if you want. You might practice with a 2 by 2. I think I gave you one assignment that had a 2 by 2 problem in it. Okay, so what we're going to be interested then is in the properties of these eigenvectors and values. And almost all of our operators are going to be Hermitian. So let's just think about Hermitian matrices. And I claim the following. The eigenvectors are, so what I have then is solutions to the equation that m times vi is equal to its corresponding eigenvalue times that vector there. So what I claim is the vi are orthogonal. And by that I mean that if I take v1 and I dot it with v2, I'm going to get 0. Automatically. And of course I can, it's no big deal to normalize them. I mean, I have to do the work of finding the normalization constant, but without any Wolog, without any loss of generality, I can make these guy be orthonormal. They span the space. So they're a perfectly good basis to use. And 3, the lambda I are all real. In general, eigenvectors could be complex. Okay, well, let's prove some of these things. So if I pick one of these VIs and I think about doing that operation, of course what I'm going to get here is just lambda I times VI. And so what I'm going to get is just lambda I. On the other hand, since this is a Hermitian matrix, I can bring it to the other side for free. And so that's going to give me a lambda vi vi. This thing is going to be complex conjugated, so I get lambda star. So if a number equals its complex conjugate, it must be real. Let's show that the eigenvectors have to be orthogonal. Let me have v1 that has eigenvalue lambda 1 and v2 that has eigenvalue lambda 2 and do something very similar to what we did here. So I can take v2, overlap it with mv1, and of course what I'm going to get is lambda 1 times v2 v1. I don't know that this is 0 yet. I'm trying to show that it's 0. On the other hand, I could bring the m over to this side of the equation. I'm going to get here lambda 2, v2, v1. In general, when that lambda 2 comes out, it would be complex conjugated, but we know it's real, so it's just going to give us lambda 2, v2, v1. And now let's put everything on the same side of the equation. So I get lambda 1 minus lambda 2 times v2 v1 is equal to 0. So these are distinct eigenvalues, so this thing is not 0. If something that's not 0 multiplied by an unknown equals 0, then the unknown has to be 0. Now there's a fly in the ointment. What happens if the eigenvectors have the same eigenvalue? So we need a name for this degenerate. And it's degenerate in the same sense that the roots of the resulting polynomial are degenerate, right? We have a double root. And I don't know, did you guys have a name for the determinant equation that we were talking about? It's not uncommonly called the characteristic equation. So these words characteristic and eigen are thrown around this way and that. I guess I've never really seen that called the eigen equation. But. What can we do? So let me first of all show you a really kind of stupid example. So this thing is, it's certainly an eigenvector with eigenvalue 1. It's also an eigenvector with eigenvalue 1, and they're not orthogonal. But on the other hand, we know that this guy here is also an eigenvector with eigenvalue 1, and it is orthogonal, and it spans exactly the same space along the pair, either the old pair or the new pair, span exactly the same space. And so that's really the claim here. If they are degenerate, then they may not automatically come out orthogonal, but you can always select a set that is orthogonal. And the process for doing this is called the Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization procedure, and it's pretty dull, so I'm not going to talk about it. Usually you can see your way through to make them orthogonal. If we think about what the representation of the matrix looks like, if we use the eigenvectors as the basis, so we've said that if T operates on some basis vector I, we're going to call this sum that. So what happens if this is an eigenvector? Well, that means in this sum, the only term is the corresponding eigenvector times E1. So instead of having a whole possible column of available entries, we're only going to have an entry on the diagonal. So the matrix that represents T if we use the eigenvectors as the basis, is just going to be the eigenvectors down the diagonal and zeros every place else. Well, that begs kind of an ugly question. The matrix that represents T depends on what you choose for a basis. If you choose a different basis, how does T change? We see that if you choose T to, if you use the basis that is eigenvectors, T is particularly simple. But you know, how if you choose any old basis, how would it change? And again, to kind of give you an example of why you might want to do this, if you think about the moment of inertia tensor, changing basis is like choosing a rotated frame of reference as opposed to the existing frame of reference. And what you know, what you might remember, is if you choose a coordinate frame that's aligned with the principal axes, then the moment of inertia tensor looks particularly good. It's just down the diagonal. So this change of basis in terms of 191 sort of stuff is kind of the equivalent of just choosing a rotated coordinate frame. So how does this work itself out? So let's say I have my original basis vectors, EI, and I'm going to have some new basis vectors, F. And of course, if these things are a basis, I can write my original basis vectors as a linear combination of these vectors. So again, kind of with knowledge of forethought, I'm going to label these things S sub j I. And if you just work the linear algebra, it has to be the case that if I take the inverse matrix of this Sij and I put them together, I have to be able to get the Fk out. So if I add up over I the inverse matrix of sum over k, why would I sum over k? I don't know why I did that, but I did. So that's just using the linear combination that is the inverse to get you around the other way. Okay, so now kind of the ugly part. What I want to have is what the matrix representation is of T in the new coordinate system. So what I need to find is, seem to make odd choices. What I need to find is that T operates on some FJ, then the expansion coefficients that I get are going to be the matrix that represents T in this new basis set. And of course, I can use this to tell me what the what F is in terms of the old basis set. So what I've got is T operating on the sum of K S inverse J, because this is the J. Oops, sorry. There are too many K's there. Okay, this is an I. Okay, so then I've got, to get Fj, I want S ij of ei. This is now a sum over I. And what I've got then, T can operate, this is just a linear combination, so T can operate on that vector. So I've got the sum over I of S inverse of ij, and then I have T operating on the ei. When T operates on the ei, we get a linear combination. The linear combination we get is Tj I ej. And finally, we can write that Ej in terms of a sum of the Fs. So this is the sum over I and J. And now we have a sum over some new index, K, of S inverse Ij, the old matrix that's representing T in the original basis set. And then we've got here SKJ FK. Those guys are the same. Okay, so this is kind of a long way around the block. These are just numbers, so I can rearrange them any way I want. So this is SKJ, this is TJI, and this is S inverse IJ, all times FK. And I hope you recognize that what we've got here is matrix multiplication. Right? So this repeated index, is just matrix multiplication. So the matrix that represents T in the new basis, in the F basis, is just equal to ST, S inverse. And so that's a similarity transformation. So when you choose a coordinate system, I mean, everything changes. So when we choose a new basis set, all of the elements that we're going to have to represent our matrix change around in kind of a random fashion. And that, I mean, what you choose for a coordinate system is not fundamental, right? So what we're really interested in are the invariants. What are the things that don't depend on the choice of coordinate system? They're what's fundamentally going on, right? What the force is in the x direction depends on what you choose as the x direction. But the magnitude of the force, that's going to be the same in any direction. It's an invariant. So what are the things that are invariant under similarity transformations? Those are the things that are fundamentally true of that matrix. Well, the determinant is invariant. You might remember that the determinant of A times B is equal to the determinant of B times A. So that means that the determinant of ST, S inverse, is the same as the determinant of S inverse ST, and that's the same as the determinant of T. This exact same property is satisfied by the trace. Anybody remember what the trace is? It's the diagonal elements added up. Now, if you think about it, the determinant of this matrix is just the product, and the trace is just the sum of these. So it sure looks like there's hope, and it is true, that the eigenvalues are invariant to this change of basis. Okay, so the eigenvalues are the most general thing, right? They include the determinant and the trace. The eigenvalues are invariant under similarity, so they're kind of the things that are really fundamental about a particular operator, because they don't depend on the choice of coordinate system. They're kind of the equivalent of the magnitude of a vector. So they're kind of equivalent to the magnitude in the sense that they're invariants. So just as the magnitude of a force doesn't depend on the coordinate system, even though the x component of the force depends on the coordinate system, the set, the whole set of eigenvalues of a matrix doesn't depend on the basis that you're using. Those are all invariant. It certainly makes good sense that the determinant is invariant, right? Because that affects whether its inverse exists or not. And the existence of an inverse shouldn't depend on what you're using as a basis. But it's more than that. The whole set of eigenvalues is independent of the basis set. And so they kind of represent the core, the kernel of what an operator is, the piece that doesn't depend on the basis. And that's one of the reasons why we'll focus a whole lot on eigenvalues. Well, so there are all sorts of special cases, right? So like for the moment of inertia tensor, you know, here are three numbers that represent it, but they also then represent, you know, something physical, that if you rotate the object about that direction, you get angular momentum that's in that direction. And typically what it means, if you rotate the object around that dimension, it's stable. So they may have additional properties in addition to being invariants. But they're, if you're going to make a, since the coordinate system shouldn't affect anything that's important, and these things are unaffected by coordinate system change, they have the best chance of being the important characteristics of the operator. And at least off the top of my head, I think they're always the important things about the operator. Oh, I guess, I think I mentioned before the famous dead physicist Hilbert. So once we have a linear algebra and we add to it this inner product the way we've been doing it, then we name the result a Hilbert space for this famous dead physicist Hilbert. There are also Banach spaces that are kind of halfway between linear algebra and Hilbert spaces that are named for another famous dead mathematician. Linear, of course, was a real important guy.